Thanks for coming, everyone. So I'm Eric Eitrum. I won't do my whole introduction. Most of you I've seen before at some of the other sessions this week. But I'm a radiochemist, so I'm trained in radioactive materials. Someone earlier asked if it's like radiochemist, oh, AM or FM. not the case. So nuclear chemistry is kind of my topic. So today I'll talk actually quite a bit about nuclear power. That'll be one of the things that I'll talk about because that's something closer to my specialty and something that's probably not that well understood generally. And that pertains a lot to scientific literacy surrounding energy production, notably nuclear power. And the ethics surrounding energy production are incredibly, incredibly complex. There's no way that we could touch on all of this in 90 minutes, nor am I specialized enough to talk about it in extreme depth for a long time. So just as a side note, commercial energy production is not the only contributor to climate change. There are lots of other factors, though we will be talking about climate change as one of the major reasonings for picking certain energy production techniques over others. Does anyone have any other contributors that you know of that maybe aren't pertaining to energy production but would contribute to climate change?
Methane?
Yeah, okay, methane from what sort? Any sorts of sources that you know of?
Cows.
Cattle, so like, yeah. Our food choices, of course, we know pertain to global climate change.
Deforestation,
that's a huge one. So the first one I said, fossil fuels are not the only factor. It's roughly 3/4 of our CO2. Deforestation is a huge contributor as well. Yeah, certainly. Any other ones?
Am I reading that right, or does that math not allow for any more?
That's why it says roughly, and that's just with CO2.
So the rest,
and this would be anthropogenic CO2. So
the rest are smaller.
Yeah, there would be some smaller, and that's just CO2. We know that there's other greenhouse gases, right? Like methane, certainly.
Okay.
So some other ones: refrigerants. Turns out these HFCs are also greenhouse gases that are super, super potent, but in really, really tiny quantities. So that's something that we change some refrigerants that would potentially pertain. Cement production produces a lot of CO2, but I know you mentioned 3/4 and 1/4. But fossil fuels, also that's transportation. So a lot of that is also in transportation. It's not necessarily just in our commercial energy production. Okay, so there's a lot of other things that we can talk about. Yeah, transportation being a big one. Food choices, notably cattle. Lots of methane production, methane being a very potent greenhouse gas. Global population, turns out education opportunities, notably for women, can affect global population trends dramatically. Certainly the more people we have, the more resources we're by necessity using. As industrialization occurs, we're also using more and more resources. So there's lots of other topics that we can talk about in terms of climate change. Total energy usage is a huge portion of this, so efficiency and total quantity of energy that we're using also is a major factor. There's lots more that I'm sure we could talk about. I'm going to focus in just on the energy production techniques, right? The commercial energy production techniques, since we have a limited amount of time. Factors to consider in determining energy production techniques. What sort of factors do you think we should talk about in terms of when we're trying to pick what sort of energy production technique we should utilize? Any sort of factors you think should be noted?
Sustainable.
Okay, sustainability, yeah, that can mean lots of different things, right? Economic, environmental, lots of different, yeah.
The effect on the environment.
Effect on the environment, certainly, that's a huge one.
Costs, security,
absolutely.
What we get for what we're doing.
What we get for what we're doing.
Storage,
yeah.
Risk factors.
Yeah, very multifaceted. Some of the ones that I think is really important is a total life cycle assessment of an energy production technique. So cradle to grave, so you have to include everything associated with that energy production technique, not just the cost of the fuel or the cost of building that facility or something like that. It's also the decommissioning. It's also the long-term ramifications of, for example, nuclear waste storage. That should be included in the costs of that power production technique. Likewise, how do you even start accounting for things like environmental factors? How do you start accounting for global climate change costs? Because a lot of that is unknown, right? We know it's non-zero, but beyond that, we don't really fully understand how expensive that's actually going to be. So it's really important to think about kind of a lot of the different facets associated with energy production, not just kind of some of those immediate costs or some other things. Economics, we know, is a huge driver when it comes to that, so that's an overarching theme. We know that we're picking our energy production techniques almost exclusively based on economics, and social justice being another aspect. So if you're storing nuclear waste in, on a Native American reservation, for example, there's lots of social justice implications associated with that. If you're putting oil refineries in low socioeconomic neighborhoods, for example, there's issues associated with that. So there's lots, and this is again an overarching theme that we can apply to almost every other thing we talk about. Kind of what we've talked about, environmental or health, resource depletion, so water, minerals, biotics, things like that, land use ideas, so biome disturbances, different speciation, right, things like that could be a factor. A lot of times these land use are multi-use. Greenhouse gas, GHG, you might see that a bunch, greenhouse gas emissions. There's not just CO2, we know of other ones like methane. These fluorocarbons, another one that's becoming more and more important. Other sorts of emissions for environmental impact. Other emissions that can cause things like acid rain, okay? Likewise, ozone depletion, some things like that, or other sorts of things that might be ecotoxic. That's what I mean by those sorts of emissions, not just greenhouse gas emissions. Emissions when it comes to human health, so if you have particulate matter, we know that breathing in, cardiovascular disease associated with these fine particles, that's something to be concerned about, or ground level ozone, which is different than ozone depletion that causes the ozone hole. Ground level ozone, it turns out, is bad for human health, so emissions associated with human health above and beyond greenhouse gas emissions. Waste management, toxic metals, for example, would be a big portion of that. Nuclear waste, any sort of radioactive waste is a big portion of waste management. Obviously, there are so many things that we could talk about when it comes to factors to consider when we're picking energy production technique. But many of them could go under some of these big, huge, ginormous categories. And so we won't have time to talk about every little aspect or every large aspect of all of the different energy production techniques, okay? So you'll have to bear with me for that. Overall, there's just a huge increase.
Those of us leaving have a party of family.
Hannah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So overall, there's been a huge increase in energy production globally. And it's in everything, right? So liquids is petroleum products, right? So we're seeing that there's just increase in energy production generally. So we are getting to pick now kind of what sort of energy production techniques we would like to invest in and use. Again, there's lots of issues associated with this when it comes to what maybe the U.S. would pick versus what a different developing country would pick, and how paternalistic can we or should we be, and allowing them to industrialize using liquids or coal versus trying to advocate for renewable energy. So social justice aspects are abounding here as well. But the main thing is that we're just producing a lot more energy, and in the future, we don't really see that slowing down, right?
Coal energy is increasing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
That would be in the world, not
in the world. So yes. So this is a world perspective.
Yes.
There are huge countries like China that are investing, have invested a lot in coal, and lots of developing countries, or whatever you want to call it. If you were at some of my previous talks, I really do like this effect. I think it's really interesting. It's this Dunning-Kruger effect on climate literacy. I think a lot of climate change and energy production, there's a lot of misunderstandings around it, and a lot of people don't know a lot about it. And there's this interesting effect that can happen where you actually have a lot of confidence in a field. If you know very little about it, you kind of assume it's fairly simplistic. So if you have like a one or two sentence anecdote about why wind is good and why coal is bad, people kind of assume that that's all there is to it. And so you actually have a lot of a high confidence in your knowledge in that area, even if your knowledge is quite low in the field. As you learn more and more, oh, there's more to it than I thought, and your confidence goes down. Oh, I'm never going to understand this. It starts to make sense. And then I would say as your knowledge increases in the field, your confidence probably goes up more like this, right? But to some point where it's like, wow, this is really complex, far more complex than a couple news articles can really display for us, or a 90-minute presentation, right? So it's something to just be aware of. This gets challenging. You can kind of see this occurring sometimes when we have people not really listening to expert opinions and things like that, where 57% of people believe that scientists generally agree on human-caused global climate change, 37% don't. We would potentially agree more with experts if we knew a little bit more. I think kind of once experts can become useful is once you're off this high point into that there's more to this than I thought. If you already think you know everything about it, why would you consult an expert, right? Why would you kind of go searching for more facts? You kind of already know enough to be confident in your results. So this is something that I think is kind of in the background happening a lot in lots of scientific disciplines, and I think energy production is no different. So let's just talk about some of the basics. Most are ways to turn a turbine to produce electricity. So here's a turbine. You have a coiled copper wire, and there are magnets around it. Turns out as you spin this copper wire in a magnet, you produce electricity. So as that travels, so this is how we produce most of our electrical energy. One of them is geothermal. This is different than maybe the geothermal that you're familiar with. We're talking about commercial energy production. So geothermal, you might have neighbors or your house that has geothermal, where it keeps your house at 55. So you kind of in the summer, it's cooling. In the winter, it's warming. That's not what we're talking about here. This is actually for energy production, where you go really, really far down. You put some sort of fluid down there, like water, and steam comes up. That steam will turn the turbine and producing electricity. Okay, so that's kind of one energy production technique. We have coal, oil, natural gas, or biomass. This, you burn it, you produce heat. That heat will boil water. Water will then turn that turbine, doing the exact same thing as previously, producing electricity. Okay. Biomass being things like biodiesel or wood. Okay, so this is what we mean by biomass. Other sorts of like agricultural waste can certainly be used for this. Nuclear is a very, very complex way to boil water, but ultimately, you know, splitting an atom in order to produce heat energy. That heat energy, same thing, boil water turning a turbine. Wind, a little bit easier to understand. We see the turbine actually moving, right? The turbine in the upper housing, mm-hmm. and it's being turned by wind, right? Wind power. So we're familiar with that. Hydro, same sort of thing. The power of the water, it's based on the height of that water, so it's gravitational potential energy, okay, so it's the height of that water, and then the quantity of that water that is pushing and turning those turbines. Another one being concentrated solar power. This is one you might not have seen or thought much about before. That's the one where you see all the mirrors pointing at one tower in the middle. You might have seen some photos. I have a photo later with that. But you're using all the heat energy from solar to, again, same sort of thing. You heat up something, and that something will ultimately be used to boil water to then turn a turbine. So a lot of this is ways to boil water. Okay.
As opposed to a solar field.
Yes. Like PV, photovoltaic, and that is one where we're converting light directly into electricity with no moving parts.
Right. Okay.
And that's no turbine, right? So there's some advantages to no moving parts. Turbine technology hasn't really changed much. This has been around for a long time. So for example, here we have some hydro plants, and their turbines, I think one was 1902 and one was 1914. Mm-hmm. They're essentially identical now. I mean, there's no real change in electricity and magnetism throughout that time. So the technology is old, it's also very good, but still moving parts, those things wear down. So the attractions to something that doesn't have turbines turning is really kind of interesting, right? There are other downsides. So no moving parts is a huge advantage to photovoltaic. One that you might maybe you've heard a little bit about previously, hydrogen fuel cells. This is taking chemical energy and turning it into electricity. This is not really an energy source. We don't mine hydrogen. It's really an energy medium, not too dissimilar to electricity. So we're not actually ever going to get energy from hydrogen fuel cells, like net energy gain. This might be a good way to store energy, but sometimes people talk about this as an energy production technique. It's really an energy storage technique, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. There are lots, I mean, I'm sure, just generally, there's so much that we could talk about right here, just alone, in terms of pros and cons of each of these sorts of production techniques. And I'm quite sure that you as a group would collectively know a lot more about all these energy sources than I individually know. So just fairly briefly, if you want to kind of talk in small groups of three or four, you probably have some preconceived notions about these things, whether you're like, oh, I generally think that that's a decent route forward versus, hey, we should probably be getting rid of that as best we can. And kind of talking just a little bit with each other about what pros and cons you're already aware of with each of these.
I don't know what it's even called, but using tides?
Tidal, yeah. So tidal wave is another one. I didn't talk about that one. There's pretty good chance that it's never going to be a huge energy production in the future.
But does it turn a turbine, or is it?
There are a few kinds. Okay. So one does turn a turbine, and that's the tidal one, where you put these, like, essentially think of like a little mini wind farm in any place where you're going to have a tide coming in and out. It's not wind, but of course it's water going through there. The other one's like wave action, so just the up and down of the waves in the middle of the ocean, that being enough kinetic energy that you're converting into something like electricity. There's a pretty good reason to believe that, at least in the near future, like next 50 years, it probably can't be more than about 1% or 2% of our production, but one of the things that I do pretty firmly believe is we have to have a mix of a lot of different things. We're never going to pick one that's going to all of a sudden be able to take over everything. So having a really good mix of lots of different energy sources is probably a good idea. And it would include tidal and marine, which, yeah, I didn't talk about here. So there are more than even these, but a lot of these are some of the bigger players that we're, or we're at least currently investing in bigger ways, where that's still a lot in like R&D production. Yeah.
What's the issue with tidal?
The one that they're doing on like coasts, would be the sediment ends up getting trapped in those turbines more so than what they had previously thought. Another one is the tide, you know, doesn't come and go all the time, so you're not always having tidal action, so it's not constantly producing energy. Wave is better in that regard, but wave's out in the middle of nowhere, and it turns out in order to get that to not move, they attach huge cement blocks to it. So just the amount of cement that they have to produce for one of those is really substantial. So that's kind of why I think the technology, what it looks like now is probably not what it will look like in the future. We don't really know what that looks like, but there's certainly lots of research going on in that area to try and see kind of the viability of it. So that's the future energy production. I don't think we have any, currently don't have any commercially viable options. So anytime you would see something like that, it would be small production, trying to see, hey, what works, what doesn't. Where all of these currently have commercial production. Doesn't mean they can't have improvements, they certainly can and should, but yeah.
Just thinking about the fact that the basic turbine technology has not changed dramatically in the last two centuries.
Yeah.
How much growth is there in terms of efficiency using different kinds of magnets or different kinds of conductors to make that more efficient, produce more electricity with the same amount of input?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not entirely sure. So magnet technology, these are all permanent magnets or electromagnets. So they take a little bit of electricity to get them to be superconducting, right? If we could get a room temperature, at least relatively low temperature, superconducting magnet, which some people think is never going to happen. Right now we can get superconducting magnets that will happen at very, very low temperatures, very, very extremely low, but if we could get them to even like negative 80 degrees Celsius, that would be that would change this technology entirely. And you'd be able to get a lot more energy without using, yeah. So that would be a big, but as far as conduction of copper, I mean, that's, you do lose a little heat energy to these turbines. So if you could get something that would conduct better in the future, that would be cheap, that is not copper. People thought that this would be carbon-based materials. There's a chance that that gets better in the future. It's very likely. I don't know if it would ever displace, not ever, but in the near future, I don't see it displacing this technology.
So when I was growing up, it seemed like all the talk was about cold fusion, whatever happened.
Yeah, I was hoping to not talk about that. Okay, so it is something I know about. So, for the last 50 years, we've been 15 years away from cold fusion, yeah. Right? And we're still 15 years away. It's one of those, I think it's safe to say, I'll believe it when I see it. There is a chance that would occur, and that could revolutionize a lot of our energy production. Because you could get just an absolutely massive amount of energy from that, far more than nuclear power. And nuclear power, when we talk about amount of energy, it's called capacity. Nuclear power has huge capacity. This would be many, many times larger. Cold fusion. So there's definitely still research in the area. We have these reactors. The first reactor that they finally think went energy positive has been built. But energy positive doesn't mean commercially viable yet.
Where is that? Where are they doing the research on it?
Mostly Europe, but it's international collaboration. So
that's fusion, but that's not cold fusion, right?
Yeah, that's cold? Hot fusion. Yeah. Very, very hot with huge amounts of magnet.
Cold fusion is a different effect that is debatable whether that was ever really a real thing.
Yes. So what they're doing is very, very hot fusion with intense magnets to make it all in one location. So trying to replicate what's happening in the sun, essentially. But fusion, you have access. So as opposed to fission, which is splitting of an atom, fusion is like putting atoms together. Okay, it's a little bit like that. And you can release a lot more energy with fusion than you can with fission. Kind of an example, a sad example of that would be, we have fission bombs. Those are the original nuclear bombs. So that would be like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We have fusion bomb technology since then, the hydrogen bomb, and those can be thousands of times larger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it's the same sort of thing with energy production. The ability to produce a lot more energy from a fusion technique really is there if you can do it. But turns out it takes a lot of energy in order to get the situation correct, which is high pressure, high temperature, like the center of the sun. Turns out you use a lot of energy to get those conditions. So can you really get more energy out of it than what you just put into it? The answer is like tentatively yes, but how much will that be worth it? I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
Then there's the other end of the scale, potato batteries.
Yeah, that's right. For very small energy production, that's right. Yeah, not commercial energy production. That'd be a lot of potatoes. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so if you gotta just talk amongst yourselves, small little groups of like three or four people maybe, about what you do or maybe what you don't know about each of these or kind of sorts of preconceived notions you have about any of these, positive or negative feelings. Go ahead and chat for a bit.
But it also Yeah, also a pretty main market.
They do have some in terms of getting us to be fossil free.
Things like biodiesel, ethanol. If you think about water usage,
agriculture.
As a group, did you guys have some similarities?
Wind and hydro.
Okay, wind and hydro, generally positive associations.
And solar.
And solar, okay, yeah. Those are big ones.
Geothermal.
Geothermal, okay. Any negative ones?
Nuclear.
Coal, oil, natural gas.
Fracking,
yeah.
Well, hydro is great because the energy is cheap, but it causes a terrible effect on the environment.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, you know, sedimentation, flooding of lands, right? If you're worried about fish migration upstreams, right? So some of them, yeah, kind of depending what weight you put on some of those, it can be pretty good. It is very inexpensive, really huge capacity, though we're reaching kind of the max end of that capacity. Yeah, okay, so that's hydro. We know a lot about that in this area, right? There's lots of hydro.
Yeah. And actually, just one little footnote about hydro is that as the glaciers recede, the capacity that hydro will provide will change.
Yeah, interesting. I never really thought about that.
I have just a question about, okay, so here's the energy sources. Are they all stored in the same way, or are there some that are easy to store versus?
Yes, that's a huge ticket item. Yeah, that's what I'm going to talk about. So storage is a huge issue. That's it turns out all our storage techniques are awful. So so this is, you know, kind of, I think generally we have positive associations with what we call renewable energies. Generally negative associations with non-renewable energies. So coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear, hydrogen fuel cells, kind of take that off here. This is not, it's not really an energy source. Again, it's an energy medium. So it's really a way of storing energy. And that would be only if we had infrastructure available to do so, which of course we never really bought into the hydrogen fuel cell economy. There was a time where maybe that was a bigger deal than it is now, where people thought maybe that was gonna be something we would utilize more heavily. Generally I find people have positive associations with renewable, with a few nuances, right? We know that all energy production techniques have negative side effects, like all of them do. So ideally we just produce less energy. Try and convincing the US to do that. But another aspect of that is kind of getting at this energy storage idea. It's called dispatchable energy sources versus non-dispatchable. Dispatchable means it's on demand, so high energy production, you can stop and start. As opposed to this variable output technologies where their production doesn't stay constant. So we know that the sun is not always shining, we know the wind is not always blowing. Even hydro, as Holden is familiar with, right? There's variable output. When there's a lot of glacier melts, you get a lot of hydro production here in the village. In the middle of winter, however, they have a lot less energy production here in the village because they're hydro-powered. So you have kind of variable output there. This doesn't necessarily mean one's better than the other, but it's a hugely complicating factor. And this tends to be one of the challenges with converting everything to renewable that we sometimes forget about, that we at least with our current infrastructure, we absolutely must have dispatchable energy sources.
I'm sorry, I was probably outside when you went over this, but I don't know what biomass is.
Yes, okay, so I only briefly mentioned it. So really biomass would be wood and things like when you hear about ethanol and biodiesel. Those are primarily what we're talking about. Some agricultural waste, some people will even include things like even burning methane from decomposition of something, they would consider that biomass. And generally, we call this renewable because I was describing to this group, it's short cycle carbon versus long cycle carbon. You're still producing CO2 when you're doing this, but since you assume whatever you just burned is regrowing, that in the long term, it can remain relatively carbon neutral. The big downside would be, well, the initial clear cutting of a forest, let's say, to start growing a lot of agricultural something or other, the payback period for that CO2 loss and that deforestation is massive. So that's really a very challenging aspect with biomass. Not one I'm going to focus on a bunch, but it is around and we do have it. But that's probably one you didn't know quite as much about. Sometimes I hear the same thing kind of with geothermal. I described that a little bit, but
I was wondering with the biomass, so there's a project going on in our town right now, which is being funded by the Gates Foundation to basically make these self-contained, they're waste incinerators to use in developing nations and other places, and they produce electricity, clean water, and then a fertilizer as the end product. Would that be a biomass?
That would be biomass, okay. Yeah. Yep. So any sort of waste like that is okay. Considered biomass. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it's a encompassing term that means actually a lot of different things. Okay. Yeah, certainly.
Is there any large scale of a biomass, burning garbage to produce?
So it could be much larger than it is, but by and large, it's not a huge portion of our grid. No, not currently. But it has the capacity. Well, its capacity is still fairly low, but it still is dispatchable. You could have kind of a contiguous burning if you had enough fuel, right? Just like oil and petroleum products, you could have. If you had enough fuel, you can keep them running, and the same with nuclear. But if you had enough fuel for this, you could keep a plant running, right, and kind of continually output that energy.
I used to think of all energy as energy from the sun that was either stored or being released, mm-hmm. and that was the source of all energy. Now I'm wondering, with nuclear and geothermal, are those different?
Yeah, so those are... ultimately the sun would be responsible for the reason we have wind, okay, right? So that you can kind of connect a lot of these to ultimately the sun. But nuclear and geothermal would both be the formation of our Earth, would actually be the source of that energy, right? So nuclear being technically a supernova at some point, right, that's producing these really, really large atoms like uranium, that's the original production of those. Then geothermal, yeah, that would be something associated with you have the hot core. Part of that is from radioactive decay. Part of that is from the spinning center, right? So some like, but that would be from the Earth formation. So those would technically, I think, probably be outside of that. But most of them, you're right, you can kind of draw back to the ultimate energy source being the sun. Yeah,
thanks.
Kind of interesting, yeah. Okay, so there's a lot going on here. It's really, really hard to compare dispatchable to non-dispatchable technologies, but we kind of have to because at some point we're picking between them. You're kind of picking whether you're going to try and boost wind and solar, which certainly is a big thing that's occurring right now, versus trying to build a natural gas plant, okay? And they're really, really hard to compare. And a big aspect there being storage. So again, we have this overall energy increase. But as far as the US, this is our total energy consumption by energy source. So again, this isn't from commercial energy production as well, because petroleum is almost exclusively used for transportation, things like that. It's not used for commercial energy production. You can see we still have petroleum, natural gas, and coal still is at 80% of our energy is still coming from fossil fuel, right? Small portion from nuclear, small portion from renewable energy. You can see like biomass, biomass waste, biofuels, wood, hydroelectric, wind, solar, geothermal are all portion of this renewable energy in our current energy consumption. Kind of looking at it, you thought there wasn't gonna be any tables, I'm sorry. There's so many tables. This is electricity generation. And now you can see nuclear is more like getting closer to 20%, renewables 17%. Petroleum goes down to essentially zero, but still coal and natural gas are huge players. Now 64% of our electricity is still coming from fossil fuels. So again, if you do have grave concerns about global climate change, this is a clear downside of fossil fuel production.
So go back.
Yeah.
What does that say? Why is petroleum zero?
That we generally don't use it for commercial energy production. We're using them for internal combustion engines, like transportation.
Got it.
Kind of differentiating between
electricity production.
Yes, this is electricity production. So it's kind of, it depends on how you represent this. But this, if this goes from 37% to zero, it makes sense that. So sometimes you'll hear nuclear is 20%. Sometimes you hear it's 10%, and that's kind of the time. I'm often was confused by that. Like, okay, how can you be that different? Well, it depends on if you're referring to our electricity production or if you're referring to just our total energy consumption. And we know that there's more things than just commercial energy production. Like I said, transportation being a huge portion of that as well. And solar, we have most of it is photovoltaic. Solar thermal is growing as the technology's gotten better. Okay, here are recent energy additions. You'll notice it's mostly, we have a lot of natural gas that's been added. Believe it or not, we have nuclear that's been added. We did have two plants that were built on a previous site in South Carolina. We think that there's no more nuclear being produced, but it's like a plot that was supposed to have four. They only built two, so now they're building the other two, and that sort of thing. So we have had a little bit of nuclear addition recently, but primarily we're getting that from renewables, and I don't think that that's terribly surprising to people, and most being wind and solar. So that's kind of what you've probably seen more of and heard more about is wind and solar. And here is total energy from renewables at least. See, hydropower really isn't changing that much. Biomass, not that much. Geothermal, probably not that much. But wind, dramatic increase. And certainly, I live in Oklahoma. If you drive through Oklahoma, you can see that. Or drive through Iowa, same sort of thing. You're seeing lots more of these commercial energy production plant fields full of wind turbines. And then photovoltaic, same sort of thing. We're seeing more commercial production these are solar panels, right?
What is CSP?
Oh, concentrated solar power. So that's the weird tower thing that I was talking about. So you have a big tower with all of the mirrors aiming at the tower to heat up, again, something. It's often not water right away, but at some point they just use that heat energy to boil water. There's only certain locations that makes sense. So here's where we've installed these things. So concentrated solar power kind of makes sense that it's in the desert Southwest. You have lots and lots of sunlight down there. It's very, very hot, so you're trying to heat up something to boil water to turn a turbine. So it makes sense that we're adding it in those locations. Likewise, with grid matching, if they use a lot of air conditioning in the afternoons there, well, that's also when you're producing the most energy from that source. So actually some of that grid matching makes a lot of sense. You can kind of just see where we're adding it. Wind in the Midwest and in the South, we're getting more and more wind. So yeah, Iowa, where I was, and then now I'm in Oklahoma, seeing tons of wind. So it's just kind of interesting seeing, and of course here, where we are over here, we have a lot of hydropower there still is a little capacity that we can add, so that's where we're seeing that. Geothermal, just kind of interesting seeing where we're adding these energy sources. Solar photovoltaic, again, the desert Southwest, we're seeing a lot of additions.
And these are all just commercial.
Yes. Yep.
Quite a few states that don't do any of this.
Yeah.
Oh, so this is just the top five additions. So it doesn't mean that there aren't other states that are doing, but you're kind of seeing what geographic locations are picking different sorts of energy production. So to say something as simply as, oh, we need more wind or more solar, it really does depend on the locations that we're referring to. And same thing with, as we'll find, when we're trying to compare costs as well and environmental impacts, it really matters the location that we're referring to. Yeah?
Is this the top five as a percentage of their energy mix, or top five as
for new additions.
What was that?
For new additions, based on this new additions, the capacity
additions.
Okay, but I
was wondering, like, the big states with a lot of energy would tend to rank highest just because they produce more energy in total.
Oh.
Even if, like, there might be states that are have really adopted renewables or something, but they are very small and have very little energy consumption relative to California.
That's a lot of scientific literacy. Yeah, I don't actually know the answer to that. So that could very well be that if it's just totally, of course, places like California and Texas would kind of beat out smaller states. You know, Idaho is not lit up anywhere, right, for example. Yeah, that could very well be. I'm not entirely sure. I don't think it's as a percentage. Good question. So yeah, just
a related question is whether the net increase in production versus the net consumption. I see California is up there all over the place in terms of production, but I'm not sure if they're also hedging their consumption so that there's a net benefit, or whether they're just
consuming more or not. I mean, nowhere on here are we talking about the shutting down of other sorts of plants. So I don't know if California is really cutting back on other sorts of energy production techniques that they've deemed more recently less favorable, or if their energy production is just shooting through the roof because of more and more people moving there. Yeah, not entirely sure. This is just kind of getting the general idea of location really matters when it comes to these energy production techniques. A lot of times we simplify it where it's like, oh, wind and solar are really good. And in Oklahoma, wind and solar are very good, but maybe Wisconsin, you probably don't want solar, right? That's probably not as good of an option as some other energy production techniques. Okay, again, it's still dominated, US energy at least is still dominated by fossil fuels. And this is mostly dictated on how important you believe global climate change to be in the near future. If you believe it's really going to be problematic, of course this is one of the higher issues with fossil fuels, right? If you don't believe it to be as big of an issue, that would be less of an issue. You're more interested in just the near-term economics, right? Oftentimes, well, we see that there's lots of natural gas that we're kind of shifting away from coal and turning to natural gas. And a lot of times, natural gas, the sentiment that I hear about it is, well, at least it's not coal. And generally, yes, that's true. It produces maybe roughly 50% of the CO2 per energy production as coal does. So it produces a lot less CO2. Of course, CO2 is still the major greenhouse gas that has the most driving force. In fact, these are some coal plants. People forget that these sorts of water cooling towers are not just based on nuclear. Right? These are also associated with coal, commonly associated with coal. Okay, so certainly greenhouse gas emissions based on CO2 are a huge portion of this in the transition to natural gas, saying, well, okay, at least it's still a fossil fuel, but it's not as bad as coal. It still produces a lot of carbon dioxide. Remember, natural gas is also methane, so there's a huge issue associated with methane. Turns out we have a lot of methane leaking associated with natural gas. Coal, I'm pretty sure everyone here has negative associations with coal for good reason, but there are huge problems with it. It creates black soot, carbon monoxide, there's mercury released, radioactive metals like thorium and uranium. It's actually more human exposure based on radioactivity than nuclear power waste. But that's because nuclear power waste is heavily regulated and we shield it. Of course, nuclear power produces way more total radioactive waste, right? Way more, but we shield it. But people forget about this. If you're actually concerned about radioactivity exposure, it turns out there's a little bit of naturally occurring uranium and thorium in the coal that we're burning and releasing, right? So that's something to be noted. Again, it's ounce for ounce, coal ash released from a nuclear power plant delivers more radiation because nuclear waste is shielded with water or these dry cask storage that I'll talk about in the future. So long term, you have global warming issues. Acid rain is from this SOX. X is just any number of less chemistry, it's fine. Poor air quality, so this nitrous oxides are associated with poor air quality, like ground level ozone production and things like that. Likewise, particulate matter. So particulate matter is called PM. So PM2.5 is a particular size that is particularly challenging. And turns out coal produces quite a bit of it. They trap most of it, probably 99%. But still, there's enough that's getting out that And in the past, it was really bad. Of course, now it is better. Kind of as an interesting side note, the sulfur that's being produced, it forms these things called aerosols. And aerosols, for global warming perspective, actually has a net cooling effect. This is often touted by the coal industry. So if you look at like the eastern US that has a lot of coal, it's actually relatively low sulfur, but it has enough sulfur still to produce a lot of this stuff. So if you were to look on global climate change sort of in the very recent years, you'd see that that's not warming quite as much as other areas of the world. And it's because of this occurring. The problem is these sulfate aerosols, they go away essentially anytime it rains. So it's not a long-term net cooling effect. So the second we stop coal, it actually almost makes it feel like coal isn't as bad as it actually is. But the second we stop producing, stop using coal, we're gonna feel those effects because it stops producing these actually net cooling. So it's kind of an interesting aside as far as the complexities of what's actually going on. Everyone understand that? It's kind of a weird aspect, but okay. And all this stuff is cheap, including natural gas. This is kind of our total greenhouse gas emissions from 1990 to 2017. And we're actually going down a little, but we're still producing a lot. CO2 is still the major player due to its really high concentrations. But we do hear stuff about methane or these fluorinated gases as being other greenhouse gases, especially on a 100-year timeline. Kind of two things when we think about greenhouse gases, it's the relative efficiency, so the ability to absorb energy. It depends on what gas it is you're referring to. And then the lifetime, how long does it stay in the atmosphere? So like I mentioned about those sulfate aerosols, they stay in the atmosphere on average 7 days. So in the long term, just thinking about long-term global warming effects, it doesn't really matter. Where CO2, much more likely to be something more along the lines of 200 years. And methane is about a 10-year half-life in the atmosphere. So depends really what you mean. Methane is far more potent than CO2. It absorbs a lot more energy in this thing that we call the atmospheric window. But it won't be around quite as long as CO2. So we try and kind of compare apples to apples. Sometimes we'll do that on a 100-year timeline, and that means methane would be 28 to 36 times worse than CO2, kind of gram for gram. Sometimes you might hear it as like 86 times, and it's like, what's going on? Why would sometimes it be reported as much higher than others? It depends on the timeline. So since this has a shorter lifetime in the atmosphere, if you're talking about 20 years, methane would be 80 times worse. And if you're talking about 50 years, maybe it's 60 times worse. I don't know the numbers, but so if you ever see like ranges like that, that's what's occurring, is you're trying to compare apples to apples. So you say, okay, on a 100-year timeline, maybe. Okay. Like I had mentioned, natural gas, it has a leak problem. So about 2.3% of the natural gas that is produced is leaked, which ends up being a ton of methane that's being released. Here they're looking with this little detector, seeing if there's any leakage. And you'd think that the oil and gas companies would be concerned about leaky pipelines or leaky infrastructure because it's a lot of money, right? They want to get as much natural gas production as possible. So in the past, that was what we kind of assumed was regulating them. But it turns out infrastructure is also super expensive. So we're starting to tighten down on this. It turns out if this ever reached something like 4%, it's probably worse in the long term than coal. Okay, excluding human exposure sort of aspects. But as far as global climate change, natural gas might be pretty bad as well, especially with this methane doesn't go unchecked. Here's kind of some carbon intensities for electricity generation. Nothing's zero, but you can see natural gas is about half as bad as coal as far as CO2 equivalents. And it could be, depending on how much methane is released, could be much worse. You can see here is the fossil fuels, and it's no surprise that those are the ones that are producing the most CO2 equivalents. And these are non-zero. Of course, you still have other sorts of industries that require you to transport fuel or do things like that we're utilizing fossil fuels still for. Okay. So here's some terms. So I talked already a little bit about capacity, so how much can this source produce? Capacity factor is how often is the source utilized. So solar does not have 100% capacity factor, right? It's much less because the sun is not always shining, for example, right? And even things that are constantly producing, they have routine maintenance, for example. So nothing is 100% for a capacity factor. And then, as we talked about, dispatchable versus non-dispatchable. It turns out grid balancing is a big issue, trying to match energy consumption with energy production. So something that's dispatchable can do that pretty easily. Something that's not dispatchable has some challenges with that. This ultimately comes down to issues with energy storage. So this is the costs. I love graphs and tables. So this is levelized cost of electricity. So it incorporates like capital costs, fixed costs of operating and managing it. I'm not showing you all those numbers just to focus on the other thing. So here you see capacity factors. They're saying some coal. So here's coal with 30% carbon capture and sequestration. Okay, so this would be if we were to add new power plants that would be in service by 2023. You can see like nuclear would be 90%, biomass 83%. Here's a little key down here that helps some of these things. So combined cycle, the CC is referring to natural gas. So here advanced CC ends up being one of the cheapest. So this is the expense associated with it. Again, these are the average expenses if we were to incorporate these based on capacity. So some places might be way less expensive. So if you're in the desert Southwest, that's how you can have something like solar thermal, which looks really, really expensive. This can potentially compete in certain locations. So this isn't like totally true, right? You have to remember location really, really matters. So you have to be very careful about just saying, hey, it looks like natural gas is one of the least expensive. It looks like solar is one of the least expensive with its tax subsidies, and then onshore wind. So you have to be really careful about this. But you can see, generally, my sentiment here is that none of them are off limits in terms of cost. So if anyone is kind of saying there's one is too expensive than another, the location matters way more than whatever this number ends up being, right? So it's probably not entirely true. And any one of these could probably beat out another depending on where it is you're trying to utilize it and all of that. All right. So dealing with energy storage issues. So this is the big barrier for renewable technologies, honestly. There's different ways that we can address the energy storage issue. One of them is not stored at all. It's something called a smart grid. And here at Holden, this is essentially, we have a smart grid here, where based on the energy production, you will sequentially shut off various usages depending on how much energy you're producing. And they've intentionally done that here. So if you're producing less energy, maybe the coffee pot doesn't work. I don't know, Lutherans probably wouldn't do that, but that would be dire situations, right? Or maybe you don't heat up the hot water tank. So only every building, if you talk to people who live here in the winter, every building when they have really low energy production, they'll only get a hot water tank every other day, maybe something like that, right? So you'd have your day to get a hot shower and your day not to get a hot shower. Okay, so not on demand energy. That's called smart grid. It's really hard to convince someone to do this, I think, especially Americans when they flip a switch, they want their energy, right? So this would be a way to address it, but I don't actually, just for sociological reasons, I don't see the U.S. adopting this on large scales. Another one's called the super grid, saying, well, the wind's not blowing in all locations or in any location, the wind's blowing somewhere, or the sun is shining somewhere. Why don't we just transport it? Okay, well, the wind's not blowing in California, but in Oklahoma, there's plenty of wind. Right at this particular moment, let's just transport it across the nation. Turns out Europe does a decent job with this. This is essentially their super grid, where they will transport energy, and these black lines are underwater, so they actually transport huge amounts of electrical energy across to even amongst nations. This really only makes sense if you're really, really densely populated. You lose a lot of energy transporting it over that distance. And think about the infrastructure. Certainly above ground is kind of crazy. We know that there's huge issues with that. I mean, you guys know that here with wildfires and things like that. And just the maintenance and upkeep of huge electrical grids like that are problematic. And especially the Western US, maybe you could see something kind of like that on the East Coast. maybe. But we generally don't have this sort of, it doesn't seem to make quite as much sense in the US as maybe it does in Europe. And they're really not really a super grid, but they at least have some of that sharing. So, you know, Norway being mostly hydropower, sometimes they produce too much, so they can just ship that out. Right, sometimes their hydro might not produce quite as much as they need, so they just purchase some and bring it in. Okay, so they can kind of grid balance pretty well, even though they're not, you know, and be 98% hydro.
Mm-hmm. Ours does that as well. I mean, I've read that on our electric bill. That
yes.
They balance out when you've got too much hydropower and California needs some, they ship it
yes.
from there and vice versa.
Yes, but the chance, certainly they do that, but the idea of, you know, the West Coast being totally, totally reliant on hydro, solar, and wind, you really couldn't do that without a super grid that goes into the middle of the U.S. So we all have local grids, and, you know, even that, going from California to Washington State, not really considered a true super grid.
Okay.
It would be connecting huge, vast amounts of area, right? And that would be the way to get be essentially completely based on these non-dispatchable sources. When we have a minority of non-dispatchable, it tends to not really be that challenging to balance a grid. Yeah.
Part of the challenges, from what I've read about too, are not just the technical challenges, but also the kind of political and economic challenges of like regulatory challenges. Like each grid has their way of regulating how they do the economics. So they, you know, whether you can trade certain kinds of, it's not just the power you're using, the grid services, like regulating power.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And like California is really pushing to get to zero carbon, to get to a zero carbon grid. In order to do that, they're trying to create the regulations in such a way as to favor certain kinds of things over others.
Yeah.
If they participate then in like a whole Western multi-state grid, then they have to then play by the rules of that multi-state grid, so it makes it harder to do that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure policy around that would be really challenging. Even like, yeah, certainly energy policy can push some of these things one way or another. For example, Oklahoma, a little bit of an aside, but Oklahoma would be a great place for photovoltaic, but because of regulation, they can't sell back to the grid, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, that would be a very simple thing to start advocating for photovoltaic, where, you know, so there's lots of policy that certainly can also push us one way or the other as far as either developing something that's more like a super grid or not, or yeah, playing nicely with other states or even other countries ends up being problematic. I'm sure that this has had issues like that associated with just like political issues. So the last one is storage of energy. And this one gets really challenging. They're really all silly. They're really dumb. So this is one of the new ones that I saw. So here's this concrete battery that is set up in Switzerland. It's kind of a small scale plant, but what they're literally doing is lifting up cement blocks to a certain height, and then, which is potential energy, and then when that's when they have too much energy, right? So they store it that way, and then we'll let it back down and turn a turbine, produce electricity when they have when they don't have enough energy. This has very low capacity, and that seems really rudimentary, right? And it maybe has up to a 50% payback. So you can store 50% of that energy that you had originally produced this way. One of the other ways that's probably better, it's probably the best one that we have, is pump water up a hill, literally. So again, storing that water and then run it back down through hydroelectric production. So Norway will do this because they have big alpine lakes high up. So what they'll do is they'll pump it back up, and then knowing that at a later date they'll run it back through when they're producing too much. But that requires you to have water storage at a really high location. So here you're like, oh, well, Holden could do that. But again, you'd have to figure out a location to put that water when you had
copper basin.
Yeah, just flood copper basin. There you go. So, you know, so it's kind of amazing to me it sounds really rudimentary, that technique. And that maybe can even reach a 70% efficiency, but more realistically, it's probably still 50%.
Yeah. Grand Coulee uses that.
Yes.
And
yep.
They use a naturally formed old prehistoric lake.
Yeah. Yeah, so you certainly can do it. but not in every situation, right? You kind of have to have that infrastructure ahead. I don't think anyone's proposing building big tanks or something and starting to ship it up, but if you have a naturally forming lake already there, potentially this could make some sense for storing a fair bit of energy. So that hydrogen, for example, so for hydrogen fuel cells, kind of storing things as chemical energy, the extra energy that you produce, using it to make a biofuel or any sort of chemical that then can later be converted into energy. So forming hydrogen, it turns out it takes a lot of energy to form hydrogen gas. You run electricity through water and you form oxygen and hydrogen. And then you can take that hydrogen and at a later date, mix it back with oxygen, it produces electricity and water. So it's very clean, but that's that initial splitting of water is maybe 50% efficient. So you're losing a ton of energy to try and do that. And then of course the infrastructure demands of that sort of system is also quite large. Also, you turns out to make things like ethanol, you have to do a distillation process that uses a ton of heat. So maybe when you have extra energy, that would be when you're running a still essentially to distill ethanol or some other sort of chemical source that currently requires lots of energy. So maybe that's a decent option, but again, still not that efficient. Or storing something that's really, really hot. believe it or not, you know, if you're trying to boil water to spin a turbine, well, if you could store water that's a little warmer, that'd be a way to get a little bit of that energy back. Well, of course, you can't do that for long periods of time. So it's pretty much like an overnight process that maybe you'd pump a lot of energy into, if it's a free energy essentially that you can't do anything else with, okay, we'll use it to heat up something. It could be water. Realistically, they don't use water, but that was an old timey idea. It's literally use water. So they're all pretty bad is mainly the thing. People ask me about batteries here. In the near future, I don't foresee us storing commercial quantities of energy in batteries at all. Batteries are they take a huge amount of resources to make. So storing commercial quantities really are not in the, there would have to be a huge major breakthrough in battery technology, which I really think energy storage, this is a big topic. If we could get some energy storage technique that was pretty efficient, it would totally revolutionize how we could produce energy if you could now store it relatively easily. I don't think we're gonna ever see these big batteries sitting on a corner, you know, that's storing huge amounts of energy.
But that's something that I've heard they're actively working on, because that's
the biggest hiccup
is
absolutely
natural resources to make the batteries, and those are rare.
Yeah. Using like rare earth metals to do this, and if you could do it with something else and have similar sorts of characteristics as our current batteries, you know, like being able to charge and discharge for many, many cycles without losing capacity, things like that. If you could get that with a different sort of battery, I mean, there's huge advancements there, but still the amount of energy that we produce commercially versus something that runs a car or something like that, they're two totally different scales. So I don't see that as being maybe 50 years, I don't know, but not a near-term solution for energy storage.
What about the disposal of lithium batteries when they become, is that a problem?
Yeah, disposal of batteries is a huge issue. Yeah, so I mean, we need to recycle them, but most of the internal are very acidic, so if they go into landfills, there's issues with it there. Getting those, essentially the precious metals out of them are important. Ideally, we would have batteries that aren't using these metals, that are using organic materials. We kind of probably thought they would be around by now. 20 years ago, my guess is we would have thought they would have been around by now, but still not quite there.
What's the rough breakdown in terms of sort of consumption, residential versus sort of downtown commercial versus industrial? Because we keep on talking about the production side, and you're right that batteries at the commercial production level, not happening.
Yeah.
If it was at the, if battery technology were at the consumer level, so office buildings and houses and cars and places like that, I recognize that batteries have problems. But
yeah, I would probably be
the demand side.
Pretty opposed to that. I think that just because if every building had lots of batteries and stuff like that, I think we're probably better off with other energy production techniques that wouldn't require storage than doing that. In the near future, but in the longer future, if the battery technology is going to keep getting better, it's a huge point of research. So there could be a time where it's kind of like a switch. We have this brand new technology that's really inexpensive, fairly non-toxic, doesn't rely on precious heavy metals. Yeah.
How much of the energy consumption is at the individual factory house?
So when I talk about commercial energy production, I am still referring to residential. Right. So anything you're pulling from the grid is counted in that. And there would be, it's roughly a third, a third, a third as far as what they call industrial, commercial, and residential. But I don't understand how they break those three up. Because I really don't understand exactly how they break those three up. So
your commercial that you're talking about is including our homes?
It includes your homes, okay. Yes. Yes.
And I was asking on the consumption side, if about a third of the energy consumption is in our homes and in our personal cars, and a third is in mass transit and moving things around, and then a third is in like aluminum smelting plants and things like that.
Yeah, so yeah, the distinction between commercial and industrial, I have a really hard time figuring out exactly what is meant by that. Under what circumstances would you call it commercial versus industrial? But yeah, there. Sometimes you will hear it touted that kind of residential doesn't matter that much. By far, most of the energy production and consumption is from industry and things like that. But that's not entirely true. Yeah. We as individuals have a significant portion of that as well, just from our own essentially personal usage.
Mm-hmm. You know, on the methane, is there a way to cap methane or use it? I know some garbage places have methane.
Yeah.
That they in Seattle that they take and use for energy, and I didn't.
Yeah, so like landfills will capture methane from decomposition and will potentially go and use that and burn it. You even have like proposals with cattle wear backpacks and capture all the methane and then you can go burn it. Yeah, so there's lots of ways in which we could be capturing that. The problem was that in the past it wasn't as economically feasible. So even petroleum production for oil industries, there's a lot of methane that's dissolved in a lot of oil. And in the past, they would just flame it all. They would just burn it all off because it was such a small portion that they didn't really care to do that. And Saudi Arabia still exclusively does that. They essentially don't collect any of that methane. So part of that's the policy and, it's probably better. Well, actually, I don't know. It's probably better to convert it into CO2 by burning it off than it is just releasing it as methane. But still, both of them are not great. You'd like to make it feasible for those industries to capture that methane and sell it. But they make so much money on the oil portion, it's almost like it has to hit a certain amount before they're like, oh yeah, it's now worth it for us to bring in the infrastructure and actually to collect that natural gas.
Lately, I've been hearing some of the energy companies, the oil companies and whatnot, touting carbon capture and storage.
Yes.
So you hear like an NPR or something and they'll say, oh, ExxonMobil, fire here's a carbon capture and storage to save our environment.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that is just greenwashing.
Yes.
And I know it's a thing people talk about, but
we don't have good ways to do that. I mean, the best ways we have right now are put it at the bottom of the ocean, which we think is the long-term environmental sink for CO2. Yeah, there's a chance that, so carbon sequestration, this is one of the only reasons why coal seems to not be commercially viable in the near future, is people are banking on regulation that will require carbon capture, knowing that will be a significant cost associated with future coal production techniques and things like that. And so they say that there's lots of research in it, about trapping this CO2 and then doing something with it. Well, right now, doing something with it is deep under the ocean, right? There's lots of ways. It's unclear. We don't have everything worked out with the carbon cycle on Earth. We believe that that is the long-term sink for CO2. It's much more, as a quick example, CO2 is much more soluble when it's at high pressures. And at colder temperatures, so way underneath the ocean, very, very high pressure, very cold. You think about like a soda can, crack it open, you have CO2 that's being released. Well, it was under higher pressure before, right? But then if you leave it out, at some point that CO2 will leave. Likewise, if you left it in the fridge, it would keep the CO2 a little bit longer than if you left it out in a hot summer day, right? So you can trap a ton of CO2 down there. We don't really fully understand. We think it stays down there long term, but we don't really fully understand that. So and naturally, like if I were to release some CO2 right now, we think it's probably 200 years before it makes it there as a long-term sink. But we don't know the capacity of that sink. We think it's really large. I mean, it doesn't mean that CO2 is going to even out in 200 years if we stopped right now. That's not necessarily what that means, but it would likely be lower than what it is right now, because as you get more CO2 in the atmosphere, something called Henry's Law, which will increase the amount of CO2 that dissolves in the ocean. At some point, it makes its way down to the bottom of the ocean. So for carbon sequestration technologies, essentially what they're referring to is we pump it into the ocean. We pump it into the bottom of the ocean, and we think it stays there. That's what they say.
Does that have an impact on the life in the ocean?
Certainly, yeah. So, you know, they're kind of assuming wherever they're going doesn't really have anything interesting. I think our past has probably shown us that that's not true. We're always a little surprised by what's able to survive in these really crazy climates, right? So, and then we know that CO2, when it's dissolved like that, it forms carbonic acid, right? So if you look at your soda can, it says carbonic acid. That's the dissolved CO2. So that's acidic, carbonic acid. So you make a fairly acidic situation. It is offset a little bit by the sediment down there that that's bicarbonates, which will neutralize it, but it's not going to do that right away. Mm-hmm. And we don't know how long that takes. It turns out we're not down there, right? So
instead of just wrecking our atmosphere, we can wreck the ocean as well.
Yeah, this would be really, really deep down. I mean, many, you know, a few miles, but yeah, it's
deep water horizon territory.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. So I have reservations about our current understanding of carbon capture and sequestration, considering the whole long-term sequestration portion. Mm-hmm. I don't think we fully, we certainly don't fully understand it. I wouldn't bank on it for the long-term, so.
As far as storage, it'd be interesting, I don't know if you have a number, just to get a sense of the scale of the problem relative to like what batteries are capable of. I remember reading several years ago, so it might have changed, and I don't remember what the number was, but there was something like, if you add up all the batteries in the world, it's enough to store. It's enough to store enough energy to meet our global energy needs for like 2 minutes or something. I mean, it was something small. I don't remember.
It's very small. Yeah. I don't know what the exact amount would be, but yeah, we do not have a lot of batteries, and we already spend quite a bit on batteries, and we use a lot of natural resources for batteries already, right? Mm-hmm. So battery technology has issues, big issues.
So somebody said on a TED Talk I watched that the efficiency of solar energy and lithium battery storage is improving by 40% every 2 years. Is that like Nixa's propaganda?
Solar energy was. Solar, it has a theoretical limit, and it's 36% efficiency. And we're very close to that. Mm-hmm. So a little bit, probably. It turns out, due to this process of converting light into electricity, a very necessary byproduct is heat, and that will take a significant portion of that energy, regardless of what you do with the actual material. We do have an ideal wavelength that we know will give us the best situation, and turns out that our commercially available stuff does not hit that exact wavelength, but they're a little bit off. You know, it's amorphous silicon and crystalline silicon are still our two best options. We know that there's problems with using silicon. We won't have that forever, so it's still a natural resource that will become more and more rare. We're hopeful that we will have a technology in the future that we can aim at exactly that wavelength, essentially tune it to be exactly that wavelength that will hit us the maximum efficiency. The technology certainly is getting better, and there's ways that they probably have twisted that a little bit. So one of them is concentrating solar. That makes it look like the efficiency is much higher instead of just a solar panel. I mean, you should really average everything according to how much surface area of the earth you're accounting for, right? So if you have ways in which you can concentrate it a little bit in the beginning, you'll hear people talking about, oh, it's now 60% efficient, which is literally impossible. But it's because they have some sort of concentration process in the beginning, and then saying, we'll see, based on how big the actual panel is, we get 60% of that sunlight converted into electricity. So you have to be a little bit careful when you hear some of those numbers. I'm certain that there's lots of room for improvement still. We're getting better and better, yeah.
It seems like the whole cradle to grave, in my mind, is like the bigger overlying thing, because even solar panels, so what materials are used to produce them, and you know, what does that do long term? And
we kind of forget about, we will have issues with disposing of our solar panels. We'll have some issues with that. Like I said, nothing can be perfect. So there's definitely, and their lifespans are not what we want them to be yet, right? They're not going to be producing for 60 years like we see like a coal or nuclear plant doing, right? So, but things like that, there's innovation that is around the corner, hopefully, that will help those sorts of things.
It's 15 years away.
It's 15 years away. Everything's 15 years away. That's perfect. Yeah. All right, so this is one example of like the storing things as hot. So something you probably didn't know much about before, there's the concentrated solar power. This is the kind of a photo of one of those facilities in Nevada. Kind of an interesting, right? You have all of these different mirrors that are shooting heat, and that's like white hot, right? That's why that is glowing so much. And so it's great. You can kind of meet energy demands that way. And this one's really interesting. It's non-dispatchable, meaning it's only when the sun is out, really, right? And it's a huge issue for increasing the capacity. But this one actually stores a bunch of that heat energy, like I talked about, as a molten salt. So this material that it takes a ton and ton of energy to heat up to the point where it melts, to melt a salt, many thousands of degrees. And you can store a lot of energy that way. And then at some point, you know, it stores that energy for roughly 10 hours. So hopefully that'll take you from the hot afternoon in through the evening. So we are coming up with some ways to try and store this energy. Again, it's not great, but it's kind of an interesting idea. At some point, we're going to get better and better at that, at storing energy. But it's a huge issue still with respect to our what we're kind of terming a lot of these renewable energy sources besides geothermal and to some degree hydro.
What's the scale of that? Is that like the size of a stadium? I mean, it looks...
Oh, it's huge.
Ginormous.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely ginormous, yeah. This would be like, I mean, that's like a door, right, on a big warehouse.
Okay.
So this would be very, very large. It's in the middle of the, you know, middle of nowhere, Nevada, essentially. But yeah, there's still land use issues with things like this, and certainly everything will come with some sort of cost.
It hadn't even occurred to me, but it would be wonderful to put this in relation to our rate of energy consumption.
Yeah.
Is that leveling at all?
No. No, it's not. But one of the biggest influences there really is increasing global population and then industrialization of nations. So as we become more industrialized, people are using more and more energy. So that was kind of the first thing that I talked about. That would be probably more important than technically what we're actually using. If as a society we use less energy per person, that would still be beneficial. Because no matter what energy source you use, it will come with significant costs, whether it's environmental or human health or land use, you know, that big list that we talked about before. And I'm sure there are many others, you know, that I didn't talk about. Yeah, certainly. All right, I have one last little quick thing. This is good, we've had a lot of good conversation because I was gonna talk about nuclear, and that's probably something that people don't know that much about, probably. So this I had shown on Monday, if you were there. There is a big difference between opinions between public and scientists. So generally, these particular group of scientists, you know, are much more likely to agree that climate change is mostly due to human activity. And they're also much more in favor of building more nuclear power plants. Just kind of an interesting idea. Another thing that I showed seems like scientific literacy actually plays a big role in this. So just looking, building more nuclear power plants, it turns out scientific literacy had a strong influence on that factor. You know, where political party, which I think it's often been equated with conservative ideals versus liberal, and age being another one that's a big predictor. So scientific literacy has part to do with this. We actually have a lot of nuclear power plants. There's 98 of them right now, two are under construction. There's 60 locations and we produce a third of the world's nuclear power. So it has a huge capacity generally.
What do those different colors mean?
The operators. So we only have four nuclear operators.
Okay.
So the company that owns and operates them essentially. So there's scientific literacy on radioactivity. If you were at my Wednesday talk, we talked about how big of an issue that is. All radioactivity is man-made, true or false?
False.
Okay, we're very scientifically literate, but not everyone knows that. So no amount of radiation is safe.
False.
Okay. Exposure to radiation is rare for humans.
False,
right? We're always being irradiated to some degree. There's actually an interesting, this is a linear no threshold model. We only really have high dose cases where we're able to correlate that with cancer risk. Mm-hmm. And it really depends whether you draw a straight line, which is the linear no threshold model, or we have some reason to believe it's maybe more like C or even D. This is called hormesis, where low levels of radiation might actually be beneficial. This has not a lot of scientific merit, but it has similar amount of scientific merit as linear no threshold model, which is kind of crazy. It means we don't know what happens at low doses. Yeah. You know, high doses we're referring to Chernobyl sort of situations where someone is actually irradiated at huge doses, or nuclear medicine doses, right? High doses of radioactivity and measuring the sort of increased cancer risks. But what happens when you have very, very low levels of radiation exposure? It turns out it's extremely hard to measure. You start trying to measure with epidemiological studies the 1 in 100,000 cases. Well, if you don't have 100,000 people that have been irradiated at this level, and then trying to do the stats on figuring out an increase of one cancer in 100,000, that's about the limit of our epidemiology, of the ability to do that. You can't correct for every single other factor as best as epidemiologists do that. This is interesting because for nuclear power, we really don't have any reason to believe that anyone's getting high doses. We're really, the questions become right down in here, probably like right here, as what exactly is going on. I don't really have time to talk about any of this. One big thing is not all uranium is the same. We have natural uranium. It turns out we have to enrich it to lowly enriched uranium, which we can use in a reactor. Highly enriched uranium is the stuff that we use for nuclear weapons. And this is based on the isotopes. So there's uranium-238 and 235. 235 is the stuff that we call fissile, so it can undergo fission. Uranium-238 cannot, but that's most of the natural uranium. Okay, they have different half-lives also, so, and the process of enriching is super, super challenging. You have to form a uranium gas and do this gas centrifugation in order to enrich it. It's really, really terrible, really, really challenging to do. Not all uranium is the same, which is confusing because we call it all uranium, right? U-235 is the only thing that can undergo fission, so you hit it with a neutron, okay? It forms this intermediate and it will break up. So this is what we mean by splitting an atom. And it's these things that we're concerned about. It'll produce a couple neutrons. Those neutrons will go and hit other uranium atoms, and that's where you get that chain reaction. Each one of these divisions produces a lot of energy. And then these are radioactive byproducts, okay? We call them fission products. And this is the thing that we're concerned about when it comes to nuclear waste, right? Are these are some of these byproducts? This is what the fuel looks like, by the way. And yes, it is safe to hold in your hand. You know, even though it's uranium, it's very safe to hold. Most of what we have are what we call these light water reactors, which I won't really talk about. This is what a light water reactor looks like. You can see that this is. I'm glad this works. Look at this. So you have the nuclear fuel in here, and essentially you're boiling water. It's a lot of heat being produced, and at some point you use that to boil water, produce steam. It turns a turbine, which is generated into electricity, and then it's in this third loop that condenses this steam back down, and that's the thing that you go see going to the to that water tower, essentially, right, the, where they're cooling off the water. I couldn't even find a picture, like a little photo of this without the radioactive symbol. There's absolutely no radiation coming from that, like, not even a little bit. You know, it's three loops away. But I couldn't find one without a radiation symbol, which, again, I think it has problematic. And, again, this is mostly associated with coal. Maybe they were talking about coal. Okay. The big problem comes with what you do with the waste, okay? I won't get to talk about any of the other aspects. It's noon now, so feel free to go if you'd like to go to lunch. I ran out of time, I'm sorry. So there's reprocessing or disposing of it in a federal waste repository, a geologic repository. This is really what I'm gonna talk about because I think this is one of the big issues associated with nuclear power, but I don't actually believe it to be we can overcome it, especially if we're concerned about CO2. This is carbon neutral and it is a dispatchable source. So you can produce huge amounts of energy with this that could totally displace coal and natural gas quite quickly. And if we care about long-term global climate change and we think that will be very, very expensive for us, which I think it will, this might be a really good option in the short and even in the long-term dealing with nuclear waste disposal. Which will have issues, but like I said, no source is not without its issues. I think that is probably more manageable than continuing to produce as much CO2 as we do. Even though we see that slight downturn, I don't know at what point we would hit zero, but it's not looking like it's soon, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to take you through kind of what that sort of looks like. This is the composition of conventional nuclear fuel. So it's mostly uranium-238, which doesn't do much. And then 235, which is the stuff that burns. So after 2 years, you've burned about half of it. Most of the time, we can't have it burn in a nuclear reactor more than about 2 years. And we produce these highly radioactive, rapidly decaying fission products. These things, the worst of the worst of them, have a 30-year half-life. Okay, so this is cesium-137 and strontium-90. Those are the ones, so that means half of it's gone in 30 years, another half. Roughly, you can say 5 to 7 half-lives and it's gone. Of course, it's never gone based on that half of a half. But that's kind of when we think about it being a problem. People will talk about 5 to 7 half-lives, maybe even 10. But that starts being a reasonable amount of time to engineer waste storage, right? So these are actually not problematic in the long term. In the short term, they are, but turns out you can stop radioactivity pretty easily with water. So they put these in water tanks and let most of these decay away within the first even 6 months or a year. All of that's gone. The big one that's problematic are the long-lived, what we call transuranic isotopes. These are the ones that we talk about with nuclear waste that has, it's gonna be a bajillion years before it's gone, something that you can't really engineer for. All of those are the transuranic isotopes, including plutonium. And this is really, when you talk about long-term nuclear waste storage, this is the thing that's challenging. This is the thing that should be of concern if you're talking about something 150 years from now. Not really this stuff. Even though this stuff is scary in the short term, it's pretty, I would say, achievable to engineer for such a thing. Okay, this is the radioactivity in the long term. It also changes. So here we have all these things to start. Here's cesium-137 and strontium-90, and you see they just tank. So in the long term, in the short term, they're super radioactive and problematic, but in the long term, they go away, and you have all these other things that are more concerning. Mm-hmm. Here's our short-term storage, is we store them underwater. These are the huge fuel assemblies, or we store them in these dry casks, which are radiation shielded. They're just big cement tanks. And you see they're pretty large. Right now we store them on site at nuclear reactors, which is very silly. So we have literally no plan for any of our nuclear waste, not a single plan. We only had one plan in the past, and it was Yucca Mountain, which was the long-term geologic repository, which they had some issues associated with it. And we literally have no plan for long-term storage. Right now it's stored on site in these dry casks. These dry casks are rated for about 25 years. Some of them are now 25 years old, right? So that's 60 locations in the US that are just being stored randomly as opposed to having a plan. So a lot of the long-term solutions, I think, the biggest problem being we don't have any plan, right?
How vulnerable are they to a terrorist attack?
Not very. They're due to the radiation shield and everything, I mean, you could, they're supposed to be rated for taking a 747. So that's what they're supposed, there's like one of the criteria for their nuclear waste storage options. But just having them riddled across the country just doesn't even seem intentional either. And then when you decommission the plant, now whatever small town that plant was in is now, they have this random field of radioactive waste. And you know, you're not getting a dose from it. You can stand next to one of those and, and you're not getting any radiation dose. It's being shielded, but still it's just, it's very unintentional, which is not very smart, right?
And how vulnerable are they to leaking? At 25 years.
Yeah, so you know they're supposed to take a certain drop from a certain height. They have all these different criteria. We have had none that have leaked yet, but we've engineered them for a relatively short term, and we have no long-term possibilities. I don't think engineering something that is similar to this for something along the lines of 100 years or so would be, it would be expensive, but not that challenging. We can't do it for 1 million years, which is actually the regulation that Yucca Mountain had. We had a plan. They had to do testing out to 1 million years for the radioactive dose for a farmer standing on top of Yucca Mountain. What makes them think? Okay, it's a really silly thing. There's so many issues with that. Yeah, there's gonna be a farmer on top of Yucca Mountain 1 million years from now, and that's what we're concerned about. Let's do something reasonable like 500 years or 250 years, something that, you know, anyway. So this is one of the big reasons why Yucca Mountain failed ultimately, there are other big issues with this particular location, including some social justice issues with like Native American. It turns out the only thing around here would be a Native American village. So,
of course.
There's social justice issues associated with this particular plan, but we didn't have a better geologic repository than this. I could talk a long time about this, but I can't right now. The best way to deal with this waste is reprocessing. Instead of storing it in a mountain, we have places that do this. This is La Hague in France, and what they do is they pull their nuclear waste out of a reactor, they reprocess it and put it back in to burn it. Turns out that stuff that I said is around for a really, really long time, that stuff is also fissile, meaning it can undergo fission. We can burn it. But one of the big issues, one of the big issues with all of this stuff, when these things grow in as fission is occurring and you get all these other radioactive daughters, some of them are neutron absorbers, okay? So they kill a nuclear reaction because they start absorbing neutrons. You need a certain neutron flux to keep that reaction going. At some point you have, let's say one of these that grows in, not even on, barium. So barium's a huge one that absorbs some neutrons. Boron is another one that's probably in other fission products, but just little bits of them, they're called neutron poisons. So what this will do is that even though you have a ton of fuel left that can still be burned, including all of the plutonium, so you have all this plutonium, you have all this uranium that can't be burned because you have some of these ingrowing. So what they do is they pull it out, they separate it, turn it into fuel again, and put it back in. And you can do this until you don't have any of these really long-lived isotopes. You get diminishing returns every time, so reasonably at least 2 or 3 seems fine. Where France will do it up to 3 times, they often have done just 2x, but they dramatically reduce the amount of long-term transuranic isotopes. And if we're concerned about the 1 million years from now, certainly we have to reprocess it. My guess is if we store this in Yucca Mountain or something like that, 100 years from now we're going to pull it out and burn it in a nuclear reactor anyway, because we realize the only way to get rid of it is via nuclear reaction, and you can get some energy from it, right? There are reasons why we decided not to reprocess. They're bad reasons. Okay, so again, here are the ones that we can burn again. That's a huge amount of it, right? This one is actually supported by some of these, so that would also be gone. You would turn into really just strontium-90 and cesium-137 past like the first 5 or 10 years. It turns into just these two isotopes that are important. Nuclear waste is complex, but if we now have 2 elements, you can engineer for 2 elements. To try and engineer for the rest of them, I mean, you know, all of these different actinides, which is the very bottom of the periodic table, like uranium, protactinium, thorium, plutonium, right? That's very challenging. To do 2, It seems pretty reasonable, actually. You can start to engineer for that and form a chemical matrix in which it's not gonna, you know, not gonna move in the environment. Like, you could figure that out. Currently, we can't. I mean, it's hard, much harder to figure out what we have, which is all that, right?
So why don't they do it?
Yes. Proliferation concerns is what is quoted. So plutonium-239 is a nuclear weapons isotope, right? So not just uranium-235. It turns out plutonium-239 is also one that can be used for nuclear weapons. So just like uranium, not all plutonium is the same. You can't just say, oh, uranium, oh, that must be the kind that you can make nuclear weapons with. No. You need a lot of separation technologies in order to do that. Most nations don't have that technology, right? Turns out we don't have the same process for plutonium. We need essentially pure plutonium-239 in order to have a nuclear bomb. This is not pure plutonium-239. We can separate uranium-235 from 238 because we can turn it into a gas. We have a really, really hard time doing a similar sort of process with plutonium, and it's all much more radioactive than uranium. Uranium, it has 4.5 billion year half-life and a 700 million year half-life. So it's not very radioactive. You could have a lot of this gas around in these big processing facilities, as opposed to this stuff, which ends up being really, really radioactive in comparison. So no one would ever separate these anyway. I'm not even convinced the U.S. could reasonably do that, and we're the only ones who really do any of this stuff. So there was concern because it said, oh, in this reprocessing, you would get a plutonium waste stream that's separated from everything else. Well, yes, that is true, but it doesn't mean someone can go collect that plutonium and turn it into a bomb, which was the proliferation concern that the U.S. Congress was concerned about, that essentially said no reprocessing. But it's literally entirely false. We don't have a way to do this, to turn this plutonium waste stream into a nuclear weapon. We don't have a way to do that.
So, politically, has Congress just blocked it, or what is...
But yeah, I mean, essentially when they made these decisions, which was a long time ago, I have some dates. Actually, it's not on this slide. It's like 1982 was the first time we came up with the idea of a geologic repository because we were not going to reprocess. And it said by 1998, we would have two geologic repositories. Pretty short after that, like late 80s or early 90s, they decided, okay, fine, just one. And that was Yucca Mountain, right? And so we poured a lot of time and energy into Yucca Mountain saying, well, we'll just store it instead of reprocessing it, even though France had been reprocessing just fine. But it was originally because of proliferation concerns. This is